Open records requests are an important part of transparent government, giving citizens access to a variety of pieces of information. Last year, Governor Walker issued an executive order directing state agencies to respond to open records requests within a time frame of 10 days. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty recently sent open records requests to the state's 20 largest school districts to measure their responsiveness. Libby Sobek is an associate counsel at the Wisconsin Center for Law and Liberty. She's here now to talk about the results. Libby, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, tell us what you set out to do here. Why did you look at school districts and their open records?
Thank you. Yeah, so at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, we are advocates of open and transparent government practices because they help citizens become informed voters and hold government officials accountable. The open records laws are just an example of one of those policies because it gives the public access to the same information that our elected officials have. For school districts, we think this is especially important. Parents want to have access to policy changes in their schools, and the media want to access information about school board decisions. When Governor Walker issued his executive order in 2016 that required state agencies to use best practices, it prompted us to ask, how are school districts following best practices when responding to open records requests? And we found mixed results. I can start with the good to celebrate some of our districts we looked at. Both Racine Unified and the West Allis, West Milwaukee school districts respond to open records requests within those 10-day business day recommendations.
I want to jump in before we dig too deep into those.
Sure.
And just so many people have not filed an open records request before. So what do you send to school? What kind of information are you getting?
Sure. When you submit an open records request, you're basically asking for any document that that school district may use. So an example could be an agenda for the school board meeting or a policy document that a school may be sending around to its teachers on changing practices. So if you want to get access to those documents, but they're not published on, let's say, the school's website, you can write a letter or call or go to your school and ask for to receive that a copy of that information.
Thanks. And so you were talking about the school districts that did well, got in under that 10-day window. You can please go on with that.
Sure. So we, as I was saying, out of the 12 districts we looked at, six of those did really well. And two examples of that are Racine Unified and the West Allis, West Milwaukee School District. And we really want to recognize and applaud those districts for those policies because they are demonstrating, you know, government efficiency and transparency for their citizens. Unfortunately, though, not all the districts we analyzed really met that 10-day threshold, and one of the districts completely missed that 10-day threshold. We found that Milwaukee Public Schools, on over a two-year period, took an average of 30 business days to respond to open records requests.
And in some cases, the requests are free. Some cases, they cost money. Can you talk about the variation you saw among school districts?
Absolutely. So under the open records laws, school districts and governments are allowed to charge a fee for locating the documents. And some of those fees can be nominal, as small as $15. In our research, out of the 20 districts we requested this information from, seven of those asked us to pay a fee. And the most shocking of our experience is that Madison Metropolitan School District asked us to pay a fee of over $1,000 to get the records.
And did you take these results back to the districts and show them to them and get their responses?
We didn't. We published our report a couple weeks ago and have written a column about it. And, you know, we'd love to hear what some of the districts thought. In our experience, when I spoke with many of the districts through my research, the Madison Metropolitan attorney explained to me that they didn't have a tracking document. So for in order for them to get us information about their requests, he would have to contact all the schools and all the different parts of the school district. And for us, that's, you know, concerning because Madison is the second largest school district in the state, and they should have practices in place that are training employees to be able to respond to open records requests, and they should be tracking them so people have an understanding of how well and how efficient the school district is working.
Yeah, do you have hopes that the districts that came in slower and or more expensive will start to streamline the process in the near future?
We do, yeah. I think our biggest takeaways are that school districts should be prioritizing both staffing and training for open records requests to make sure that they're responding to these requests in an efficient manner and hoping to hit that 10 business day timeline. Additionally, we hope that the districts that don't have tracking documents, that our report will spur them to start tracking these requests so that they can really understand how they're performing and how well they're serving the taxpayers.
And Libby, you've been looking at these districts for some time now. Is this something you're going to carry on into the future?
You know, maybe we'll see. We're hoping that more districts will read our report and continue to strive to be better.
Libby, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Libby Sobick. She's an associate counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. She was with us to talk about the group's report looking at how quickly the state's largest school districts responded to requests for public records. We often look at music as an auditory experience because, well, we take it in through our ears. But research shows that when people listen to music, there isn't just one section that lights up in the brain. Instead, a whole network of regions related to things like speech, emotion, motor control, and other stuff, they all swing into action. Elizabeth Margulis is director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas and a trained concert pianist. She's the author of On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind, and she's here to take a closer look at how we experience music. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm a bit of a musician myself, and I tend to try to break down music and its effect into the notes and the chords and the rhythm, but there's a lot more going on in our brains. Can you talk a little bit about how our brains process that music?
Sure. Well, it just turns out that instead of there being, you know, a particular music area that takes in sounds and processes them and produces an experience, rather, there's this incredibly widely distributed network involving the visual system and all kinds of other areas that are really working together to produce experiences of music.
So it sounds like then we don't just take in music in and of itself. We're interpreting it, our brains are, through everything else, basically.
Right. I mean, there's really fun studies where you can cross what's happening in the audio with something that's happening in the video. For example, you can show people video of a percussionist playing a note and show video from them playing a long note and cross that with audio of them actually playing a short note and ask people how long the note was. And people actually think it's longer, even when it sounds the same, if it's accompanied by video of the kind of arm stroke that would produce a long sound.
Wow. And you also write about, you know, if we're watching a performer and they're really animated versus one who's not, they might be playing the same thing. We hear, and I'll put here in quotes, I guess, mm-hmm. We hear the music differently.
Exactly. And there's a number of different studies using that kind of technique, and they really all tend to show that the expressivity displayed in movements and kind of the visual channel can sometimes even dominate the content of what you're hearing in the sounds themselves.
So that rock star really going all out and moving around and dancing and waving the hair around in the air, that actually changes our experience of live music.
Right. And, you know, it's not only what we see, it can be the information we have about what we're going to hear. So, for example, you can really change the filters people are using to experience a piece if you tell them it was performed by this amazing world-class professional versus being performed by a student.
And people rate those two performances differently. They like the professional one better, even if the tracks they just heard were exactly the same piece of music played by exactly the same person, right?
Right, right. And I mean, if that seems kind of hard to believe, you might think about the kind of experiment the Washington Post did, where they took Joshua Bell, who's of course this world-renowned violinist, and it often costs a lot of money to go hear him perform in a concert hall, and they just put him down in the subway kind of during morning rush hour, and found that, you know, instead of people stopping in their tracks and having this kind of revelatory aesthetic experience in the morning, they tended to just shuffle right by and really fail to notice that anything special was happening.
In one way, that seems surprising, but in another, I mean, if I think about how I listen to music in one situation, maybe driving, I might like one thing. If I'm trying to focus on writing something, I might like another. I mean, our interpretation of music really depends on our mood and the setting, too.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, you can think about those factors as all kind of coming together to construct the musical experience. And that would really point to the way that we're missing out if we're just looking at the notes themselves.
And how about emotions? How intertwined is the music, or are the music parts of our brain with the emotion parts of our brain?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of really fun studies on that subject where, you know, you can show that when people are experiencing pleasure in music, you can see all the reward circuitry that's active. But you can also see how you can kind of push around the interpretation people are having of a piece. In one study, we played people kind of ambiguous music that you might be able to hear as kind of positive, or you might be able to hear it as negative. And we told them that we knew something special about each of these pieces, namely we knew why the composer wrote it. And then we'd give them some really positive reason or some really tragic reason. And just by giving that people that information, we could really induce them to hear the music as really expressive of one emotional quality or another.
Now, you're a musician yourself, and you're doing this kind of science, too. Mm-hmm. Does it, as a musician, does it in some ways disappoint you that our brain doesn't have an exclusive music center?
You know, quite the opposite, actually, because, you know, I went to a music conservatory, mm-hmm. and I think if you're going to a music conservatory in you know, our time, you can feel a little out of step with people, right? And it's, you know, might feel like it's sort of a niche kind of subject over separated from the rest of human experience. And to me, the fact that all this research is showing how integrated music is with our all of our other human capacities really reinforces its connectedness and its important kind of more central role in our lives.
And that brings me to another point I wanted to get to. Can you talk about the importance of, you know, growing up with music and the culture we grow up with and the memories we attach to music?
Yes, sure. So we know that music is an especially good carrier of autobiographical memories. And you can probably most people have had the experience of kind of innocently running into some song you haven't heard since you were 14 years old. And not only do you remember all the lyrics and you can sing along still, even though you maybe haven't listened to it for decades, but you kind of remember the way it smelled, the way it felt. It can kind of really transport you back to that time. And people are just now starting to explore the possible clinical uses of that as well, because there's a number of examples of people with dementia, for example, who are able to connect to the music of their youth in a really special way.
As we wrap up, is there an unanswered question about our relationship with music that you're hoping in your own research or others that we might get answers to?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, what I'm really curious about are the kind of the way people experience music in terms of stories. So sometimes they feel like the music's really presenting a whole narrative to them. And we have kind of an exciting program for the next couple of years of cross-cultural research trying to unpack how music does that.
Fantastic. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Elizabeth Margulis, director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas and author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. For Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Jerusalem is seen as a holy city. And yesterday, President Trump made the controversial decision to recognize it as the capital of Israel. It's a break from a long U.S. policy toward Jerusalem, but Trump said the decision was a departure from failed policy. Here's the president.
I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. While previous presidents have made this a major campaign promise, they failed to deliver. Today, I am delivering.
The decision hasn't gone over well with many leaders in the Middle East and in Europe. Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what was the reasoning the president gave for changing this policy and officially recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital?
Well, the reasoning he gave was, you know, he wants to kind of think outside the box on the peace process. He feels like this is something that is a reality on the ground, that Jerusalem effectively is Israel's capital. And he just said, look, I just feel like we should just take this stand. And he really genuinely, well, he says he believes that it's not going to hurt the peace process. Now, there's another side to this, which he's not necessarily saying, but he is alluding to, which is that he made this a campaign promise. It's a big issue for many of his supporters and his base, and he wants to score a win for them. So politically, on the domestic front, this is good for him. Internationally, not so much.
Let's talk about the international reaction and then come back to the domestic side of things. Positive responses from some leaders in Israel. How about beyond that?
Basically, largely a negative from just about everywhere, even China, that they didn't think this was a good idea. The Europeans, others say that this is an issue that should be dealt with in negotiations. It's a very sensitive thing. Both Palestinians and Israelis claim the city. It's not something that's been very positive for the president. But at the same time, this isn't something that's unusual for President Trump. You know, he's taken a number of stances that have been unpopular internationally, including not being supportive of the Iran deal, the Iran nuclear deal, and also, backing out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which every other country has signed up.
And looking at the conflict over Jerusalem here, as you mentioned, both Palestinians and Israelis claim it. In some ways, they both have claimed it as their capital, right?
Correct. And, you know, there's some questions about whether the Palestinians really just want East Jerusalem, which is where a large Palestinian population lives, and whether the Israelis would be willing to settle for West Jerusalem, which they've said that they won't. They consider Jerusalem their undivided and eternal capital. Now, you know, when President Trump was talking about it, one thing that was really interesting was he kept saying that he understands that the borders are still subject to negotiations and that he respects that. And he didn't use the word the undivided capital of Jerusalem. So that leaves some room, perhaps, for the possibility that down the line the Palestinians can convince him that they should have East Jerusalem at the very least.
A little wiggle room there. And the other question was, what about the American embassy currently, like most embassies in Tel Aviv? What did he have to say about the idea of moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem or promoting the consulate in Jerusalem to be the main embassy?
He said that he's asked the State Department to start preparations for a move. They don't want to simply upgrade the sign at the consulate. They say that they want to have a new site, a new location. But that means it's going to take several years. Get that done. So in a way, he's sort of punted. It's not an immediate thing. He's gone ahead and signed a waiver that allows the embassy to continue to stay in Tel Aviv for now under a congressional law from 1995, and he's going to have to keep doing that every 6 months. But technically, the State Department is supposed to be preparing plans, presumably like an architectural plan and security plans and all sorts of other stuff for a move in a few years.
You mentioned here in the U.S. domestic support among many to do this, to move the our recognition of the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Can you talk about who in the United States has been pulling for that?
Well, there are a lot of Orthodox Jewish folks on the right side of the spectrum who support this, as well as evangelical Christians who view Israel as a major cause for them as well. So they think this is a great thing. It's caused divisions within the Jewish community overall, however, as well as within the Christian community overall. And, of course, a lot of unhappiness among the Muslim community in the U.S. and around the world, which just sees this as kind of a slap in the face to the Palestinians.
We're talking to Nahal Tusi from Politico, talking about President Trump's announcement yesterday recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and some of the controversy around that. And Nahal, let's talk about where this fits into the peace process. President Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, is the point person for trying to work on negotiations between Israel and Palestinians and other countries in the region. How does this affect how especially the Palestinians and Muslim countries in the Middle East look at this process and the U.S. as a mediator?
Well, everybody's been waiting for Jared Kushner and a handful of other White House aides to unveil this peace plan that they're supposedly working on. And, you know, what Trump just did with Jerusalem would seem to undermine that process. But our understanding is that Jared Kushner is supportive of what Trump just did, and that he believes that ultimately, even though there might be a lot of anger about this right now, perhaps for a few days, not to mention, you know, violence, that he thinks it'll blow over, and that people in the Muslim world, especially Arab leaders, who really want the U.S. and Israel to stand up with them against Iran, might go ahead and view this as an issue that they're willing to just suck up and deal with. And so he's just kind of thinking this is going to blow over, and we're going to end up being able to have some sort of a peace deal that ultimately the Palestinians and the Israelis will sign on to. I think if you ask the Palestinians right now, they'll say that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, we've seen some signs of cooperation, as I understand it, between Israel and some of the Sunni Arab states in the region, Saudi Arabia and others, as kind of a informal de facto alliance against the possible expansion of Iran, a Shiite Muslim majority country. Is that maybe one of the ingredients for a peace deal in Israel?
Well, it might be one of the factors that drives Arab countries to recognize certain things that Israel wants. I don't know that Jerusalem is one of those things. It's a very sensitive issue. So far, we've seen pretty much universal condemnation of what Trump just did from the Arab countries, including those that want to stand up against Iran. I think it comes down to, like, who's leading these countries at a particular time. The crown prince of Saudi Arabia, not the king, mind you, but the crown prince, is a very powerful person who will probably be in charge of the country fairly soon. And he seems to care a lot more about Iran than he does about the Palestinian cause.
But looking at internal politics at a country like Saudi Arabia, a lot of people there, I imagine, would not be happy if they perceived their government as selling out the Palestinians, selling out fellow Muslims and an important city like Jerusalem.
That's right. But, you know, it's all about the context, right? Is that if you can tell the population, look, you know, Iran is the bigger threat and we're not totally selling out the Palestinians. And if you can say, look, Trump didn't say that that Jerusalem has to be the undivided capital, you might be able to win your population over. At the same time, this is a monarchy. It's not like the Saudi government necessarily cares what the population thinks about everything. It's not exactly a democracy, so they're just going to kind of do what they want.
Now, moving back to our internal politics here in the United States, this is something, as you mentioned, Jared Kushner and his team are supposed to be coming up with this policy, not Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Can you talk about his role or lack of role in this announcement about Jerusalem and the peace process?
That's right. The policy on Israel and the Palestinians has been largely driven out of the White House by Kushner and a handful of other aides to the president. It's been very secret. And my understanding is that Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has not only been left out, but that he's actually really worried about what they're working on. He's concerned that it could cause fissures and lead to an even more chaotic situation in the Middle East. You know, nobody really knows what they're doing, so it's a little too soon to tell, but he has very much been sidelined. That's not to say he doesn't have plenty of other things to deal with, including North Korea, the situation with Qatar, the Iran nuclear deal stuff. But yeah, this is a big issue. This is the type of issue that a lot of secretaries of state kind of want to make their mark on, you know, peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But frankly, none of them have really had any luck so far. So, you know, if this ends up failing on Kushner's watch, then Tillerson might just be really happy he's not part of it.
Yeah, this, as President Trump mentioned, he's doing this this Jerusalem decision as a departure from the failed policies of the past. And you know, the tensions aren't as high as they have been maybe at this moment between Israel and Palestinians. But as you say, nobody has really succeeded at untying this knot.
That's right. I mean, this is one of the things that's important to keep in mind. It's like, you know, if you want to keep going and doing what people have been doing for the last 60 years, it doesn't seem like they're getting anywhere. And there's like a younger generation, you know, in Israel, but also especially among the Palestinians, who are kind of tired of the old guard and how they have led them to nothing, frankly. And people do want to think outside the box. Now, I don't know if Jerusalem was necessarily the issue you wanted to think outside the box with so early on, but people are hungry for new solutions, for new ways of thinking of things. You know, there are some who say that this whole two-state solution idea, that it doesn't even really have that much resonance anymore among younger Palestinians, who many of whom view it as something that's just never going to happen. And so they're kind of thinking maybe they should go for more of a one-state solution where they struggle for equal rights within Israel. You know, I for one, am very eager to see what Jared Kushner and his colleagues come up with. But, you know, and I think people should stay open-minded, because I do think that the past solutions haven't really worked at all. So why not try something new?
Is there any indication of a timeline for when Jared Kushner and his team are expected to come out with a plan?
I mean, I think probably the safest thing is, you know, in the coming weeks, if this Jerusalem announcement hadn't happened, they might have come out with it, frankly, sooner. But I would probably guess a few weeks, but they don't really loop us in, or sure. The State Department for that matter. So they'll tell us when they're ready. And, you know, who knows, they might have decided that they have to delay it for a while once the passions over Jerusalem calm down a bit.
And do you see, I mean, it's still early in this, do you see a passionate response, potentially a violent response coming?
Well, we've already heard of clashes in the West Bank and in Gaza between Palestinians and Israeli security forces, as well as some injuries. Tomorrow is a really important day, though, because it's Friday, and they're going to have demonstrations across the Arab world and across the Muslim world after Friday prayers. And so that's where it really has the potential to get violent. Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, has called for a new intifada, or a new uprising in the region, and a day of rage. And so I think tomorrow is really the key test. But not just tomorrow, but also, like, how long is it going to last? I mean, if it just goes away after a few days, then, you know, Trump and others can say, hey, look, you know what? We got over it. Of course, you know, in the meantime, people might die.
We'll leave it there, Nehal. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nehal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She joined us to look at reactions to President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He announced that yesterday.